After Vess turned off the lights and left the kitchen, China leaned back in the pine captain's chair, away from the table, because the smell of the ham sandwich sickened her. It wasn't spoiled. It smelled like a ham sandwich ought to smell. But the very idea of food made her gag. About 21 hours had passed since she'd finished her most recent full meal, dinner at the Templeton house. The few bites of cheese omelet that she'd had at breakfast weren't enough to sustain her, especially considering all of the physical activity of the previous night. She should have been famished. Eating was an admission of hope, however, and she didn't want to hope any more. She had spent her life hoping, a fool intoxicated with optimistic expectations, but every hope proved to be as empty as a bubble. Every dream was glass waiting to be shattered. Until last night, she had thought that she'd climbed far out of childhood misery, up a greased ladder toward phenomenal heights of understanding, and she had been quietly proud of herself and of her accomplishments. Now it seemed that she had not been climbing after all, that her ascent had been an illusion, and that for years her feet had been slipping over the same two well-lubricated rungs, as if she'd been on one of those exercise machines, a stairmaster, expending enormous energy, but not one inch higher when she stopped than she had been when she started. The long years of waitressing, the sore legs, and the stubborn pain in the small of her back from being on her feet for hours, taking the toughest classes she could find at the University of California, studying late into the night after she returned home from work, the countless sacrifices, the loneliness, the ceaseless striving, all of that had led here to this dismal place, to these chains, into this deepening twilight. She had hoped one day to understand her mother, to find good reason to forgive. She had even, God help her, secretly hoped that they might reach a truce. They could never have a healthy mother-daughter relationship, and they could never be friends. But it had seemed possible, at least, that she and Anne might one day have lunch together at any cafe with a view of the sea, al fresco on the patio under a huge umbrella, where they would never speak of the past, but would make pleasant small talk about movies, the weather, the way the seagulls wheeled across the sapphire sky, perhaps with no healing affection but without any hatred between them. Now she knew that even if by some miracle she escaped untouched and alive from this imprisonment, she would never reach that dreamed-of degree of understanding. Rapprochement between her and her mother could not be achieved. Human cruelty and treachery surpassed all understanding. There were no answers, only excuses. China felt lost. She was in a stranger place than Edgler Vess's kitchen, and in a more forbidding darkness. In all her years, she had never before felt lost, not truly lost, frightened, yes, sometimes confused and bleak. But always she had held a map in her mind, with a route marked if only vaguely, and she had believed that in her heart was a compass that couldn't fail her. She had been in the wrong place many times, but she'd always been sure that there was a way out. Just as in any funhouse mirror maze there is always a safe path through the infinite images of oneself, through more fearful reflections, and through all of the enigmatic silver shadows. No map this time. No compass. Life itself was the ultimate funhouse mirror maze, and she was lost in its nautilus chambers, with no one to turn to for comfort, no hand to hold. Finally admitting that she had been essentially motherless since birth, and always would be motherless, and with her only close friend lying dead in Edgler Vess's motorhome, China wished that she knew her father's name, that she had at least once seen his face. Her mother's maiden name was Shepherd. She had never been married. "Be glad you're illegitimate, baby," Anne had said. "Because that means you're free. Little bastard children don't have as many relatives clinging like psychic leeches and sucking away their souls." Over the years, when China had asked about her father, Anne had said only that he was dead, and she had been able to say it dry-eyed, even light-heartedly. She wouldn't provide details of his appearance, discuss what work he'd done, reveal where he'd lived, or acknowledge that he'd had a name. "By the time I was pregnant with you," Anne once said, "I wasn't seeing him anymore. He was history. I never told him about you. He never knew." China liked to daydream about him sometimes. She imagined that her mother had lied about this, as about so many things, and that her dad was alive. He would be a lot like Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, a big man with gentle eyes, soft-spoken, kind, quietly humorous, with a keen sense of justice, certain of who he was and of what he believed. He would be a man who was admired and respected by other people, but who thought himself no more special than anyone else. he would love her. If she had known his name either first or last, she would have spoken it now aloud. The mere sound of her father's name would have comforted her. She was crying. Through the many hours since she had come under Vess's thrall, she had felt tears welling more than once, and she had repressed them, but she couldn't dam this hot flood. She despised herself for crying, but only briefly. These bitter tears were a welcome admission that there was no hope for her. They washed her free of hope, and that was what she wanted now, because hope only led to disappointment and pain. All of her troubled life, since at least her 8th birthday, she had refused to weep freely, really let loose with tears. Being tough and dry-eyed was the only way to get respect from those people who, on seeing the smallest weakness in another, got a fearful muddy light in their eyes and closed in like jackals around a gazelle with a broken leg. But withholding tears wouldn't fend off the jackal who had promised to be back after midnight, and a lifetime of grief and hurt burst from her. Great, wet sobs shook China so hard that her chest began to ache worse than her neck or her sprained finger. Her throat soon felt hot and raw. She sagged in her clinking chains, in her imprisoning chair, face clenched and streaming and hot, stomach clenched and cold, the taste of salt in her mouth, gasping, groaning in despair, choking on the smothering awareness of her terrible solitude. She shuddered uncontrollably, and her hands spasmed into frail fists, but then opened and grasped at the air around her head, as if her anguish were a cowl that might be torn off and cast aside. Profoundly alone, unloved and lost, she spiraled down into a mental mirror maze without even her father's name for comfort. After a while, an engine roared. She heard the brassy toot of a horn. Two short blasts, and then two more. China lifted her head, looked through the nearby window, and saw the headlights of a car leaving the barn. Her vision was blurred by tears. She couldn't see the car itself as it sped past the house in the gray dusk, but it must be driven by Vess, of course. Then it was gone. The jaunty toot of the horn mocked her, but that mockery wasn't enough to rekindle her anger. She stared out at the gloaming and didn't care that it might be the last twilight she ever saw. She cared only that she had spent too much of her 26 years alone, with no one at her side to share the sunsets, the starry skies, the turbulent beauty of storm clouds. She wished that she had reached out to people more, instead of retreating inward, wished that she had not made her heart into a sheltering closet. Now, when nothing mattered anymore, when the inside couldn't do her any damn good at all, she realized that there was less hope of survival alone than with others. She'd been acutely aware that terror, betrayal, and cruelty had a human face, but she had not sufficiently appreciated that courage, kindness, and love had a human face as well. Hope wasn't a cottage industry. It was neither a product that she could manufacture like needlepoint samplers, nor a substance that she could secrete in her cautious solitude, like a maple tree producing the essence of syrup. Hope was to be found in other people by reaching out, by taking risks, by opening her fortress heart. This insight seemed so obvious, the simplest of wisdom, yet she had not been able to arrive at it until in extremis. And the chance had long ago passed to act upon it. She would die as she had lived, alone. This further realization might have wrung greater rivers of tears from her, but instead drove her into a bleaker place than she'd been before, an interior garden of stone and ashes. Then, as she was still gazing out the window, she saw something moving in the last of the dusk. Though it was blurred by her tears, she could see that it was too large to be a Doberman. But if Vess had gone, how could it be a man? China blotted her eyes on the sleeve of her sweater, and she blinked until the mysterious shape resolved out of tears and twilight shadows. It was an elk, a female without antlers. It ambled across the backyard from the forested foothills to the west, pausing twice to tear up a mouthful of the succulent grass. As China knew from her months on the ranch in Mendocino County many years ago, these animals were highly sociable and always traveled in herds, but this one seemed to be alone. The Dobermans should have been after this intruder, barking and snarling and excited by the prospect of blood. Surely the dogs would be able to smell it even from the farthest corners of the property. Yet no Dobermans were in sight. Likewise, the elk should have caught the scent of the dogs and galloped at once for safety, wild-eyed and snorting. Nature had made its kind prey to mountain lions and wolves and packs of coyotes, as dinner on the hoof to so many predators. Elk were always watchful and cautious. But this specimen seemed utterly unconcerned that dogs were in the immediate neighborhood. Except for the two brief pauses to graze on the lush grass, it came directly to the back porch, with no sign of skittishness. Although China was not a wildlife expert, this seemed to her to be a coastal elk, the same type that she had encountered in the grove of redwoods. Its coat was gray-brown, and it had the familiar white and black markings on the body and face. Yet she was sure that this place was too far from the sea to be a suitable home for coastal elk, or to provide the ideal vegetation for their diet. When she'd gotten out of the motorhome, she'd had an impression of mountains all around. Now the rain had stopped and the mist had lifted. In the west, where the dregs of daylight swiftly drained away, the black silhouettes of high peaks pressed against tattered clouds and electric purple sky. With a mountain range of such formidable size between here and the Pacific Ocean, coastal elk could not have found their way so far inland, for they were basically a lowland breed partial to plains and gentle hills. This must be a different type of elk, although with coloration strikingly similar to that of the animals that she had seen the previous night. The imposing creature stood outside the wooden balustrade of the shallow porch, no more than 8 feet away, staring directly at the window. At China. She found it difficult to believe that the elk could see her. With the lights off, the kitchen was currently darker than the dusk in which the animal stood. From its perspective, the interior of the house should have been unrelievedly black. Yet she couldn't deny that its eyes met hers. Large, dark eyes, shining softly. She remembered Vess's sudden return to the kitchen this morning. He'd been inexplicably tense, ceaselessly turning the screwdriver in his hand, an odd light in his eyes. And he'd been full of questions about the elk in the redwood grove. China didn't know why the elk mattered to Vess any more than she could imagine why this one stood here now, unchallenged by the dogs, studying her intently through the window. She didn't puzzle long over this mystery. She was in a mood to accept, to experience, to admit that understanding was not always achievable. As the deep purple sky turned to indigo, and then to India ink, the eyes of the elk grew gradually more luminous. They were not red like the eyes of some animals at night, but golden. Pale plumes of breath streamed rhythmically from its wet, black nostrils. Without breaking eye contact with the animal, China pressed the insides of her wrists together as best she could with the handcuffs intervening. The steel chains rattled, all the lengths between her and the chair on which she sat, between her and the table, between her and the past. She remembered her solemn pledge earlier in the day to kill herself rather than be a witness to the complete mental destruction of the young girl in the cellar. She had believed that she would be able to find the courage to bite open the veins in her wrists and bleed to death. The pain would be sharp, but relatively brief. Then she would fade sleepily from this blackness into another, which would be eternal. She had stopped crying. Her eyes were dry. Her heartbeat was surprisingly slow, like that of a sleeper in the dreamless rest provided by a powerful sedative. She raised her hands in front of her face, bending them backward as severely as possible, and spreading her fingers wide so she could still gaze into the eyes of the elk. She brought her mouth to the place on her left wrist where she would have to bite. Her breath was warm on her cool skin. The light was entirely gone from the day. The mountains and the heavens were like one great black looming swell on a night sea, a drowning weight coming down. The elk's heart-shaped face was barely visible from a distance of only 8 feet. Its eyes, however, shone. China put her lips against her left wrist. In the kiss, she felt her dangerously steady pulse. Through the gloom, she and the sentinel elk watched each other, and she didn't know whether this creature had mesmerized her or she had mesmerized it. Then she pressed her lips to her right wrist. The same coolness of skin, the same ponderous pulse. She parted her lips and used her teeth to pinch a thickness of flesh. There seemed to be enough tissue gathered between her incisors to make a mortal tear. Certainly she would be successful if she bit a second time. a third. On the brink of the bite, she understood that it required no courage whatsoever. Precisely, the opposite was true. Not biting was an act of valor. But she didn't care about valor, didn't give a rat's ass about courage, or about anything. All she cared about was putting an end to the loneliness, the pain, the achingly empty sense of futility. And the girl, Ariel, down in the hateful, silent dark. For a while she remained poised for the fatal nip. Between its solemn, measured beats, her heart was filled with the stillness of deep water. Then, without being aware of releasing the pinch of flesh from between her teeth, China realized that her lips were pressed to her unbitten wrist again. She could feel her slow pulse in this kiss of life. The elk was gone. Gone. China was surprised to see only darkness where the creature had stood. She didn't believe that she had closed her eyes or even blinked, yet she must have been in a blinding trance because the stately elk had vanished into the night as mysteriously as a stage magician's assistant dematerializes beneath an artfully draped black shroud. Suddenly her heart began to pound hard and fast. No, she whispered in the dark kitchen, and the word was both a promise and a prayer. Her heart, like a wheel, spinning, racing, drove her out of that eternal grayness in which she had been lost, out of that bleakness into a brighter landscape. No. There was defiance in her voice this time, and she did not whisper, no. She shook her chains as if she were a spirited horse trying to throw off its traces. No, 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 shit, no. Her protests were loud enough for her voice to echo off the hard surface of the refrigerator, the glass in the oven door, the ceramic tile counters. She tried to pull away from the table to stand up, but a loop of chains secured her chair to the barrel that supported the tabletop, limiting its movement. If she dug her heels into the vinyl tile floor and attempted to scoot backward, she would probably not be able to move at all. At best, she would only drag the heavy table with her inch by inch, and in a lifetime of trying, she would not be able to put enough tension on the chain to snap it. She was still adamant in her rejection of surrender. No, damn it! No way, no! Pressing the words through clenched teeth. She reached forward, pulling taut the chain that led around her back from the left handcuff to the right. It was wound between the spindles of the rail-back chair behind the tie-on pad. She strained, hoping to hear the crack of dry wood, jerked hard, harder, and sharp pain sewed a hot seam in her neck. The agony of the clubbing was renewed in her neck and in the right side of her face, but she would not let pain stop her. She jerked harder than ever, scarring the nice furniture for damn sure, and again, pull, pull, firmly holding the chair down with her body while simultaneously half-lifting it off the floor as she yanked furiously at the back rails and yanked again until her biceps quivered. Pull! As she grunted with effort and frustration, needles of pain stitched down the back of her neck, across both shoulders and into her arms. Pull! Putting everything she had into the effort, straining longer than before, clenching her teeth so hard the ticks developed in her jaw muscles, she pulled once more until she felt the arteries throbbing in her temples and saw red and silver pinwheels of light spinning behind her eyelids. But she wasn't rewarded with any breaking sounds. The chair was solid, the spindles were thick, and every joint was well made. Her heart boomed, partly because of her struggles, but largely because she was brimming with an exhilarating sense of liberation, which was crazy, crazy, because she was still shackled, no closer to breaking her bonds than she had been at any moment since she'd awakened in this chair. Yet she felt as if she had already escaped, and she was only waiting for reality to catch up with the freedom that she had willed for herself. She sat gasping, thinking. Sweat beaded her brow. Forget the chair for now. To get loose from it, she would have to be able to stand and move. She couldn't deal with the chair until she was free of the table. She wasn't able to reach down far enough to unscrew the carabiner that joined the shorter chain between her ankles to the longer chain that had entwined the chair and the table. Otherwise, she might easily have freed her legs from both pieces of furniture. She could overturn the table, the loop of the chain that wrapped the supporting pedestal and connected with her leg irons would then slide free as the bottom of that barrel tipped up and off the floor, wouldn't it? Sitting in the dark, she couldn't quite visualize the mechanics of what she was proposing, but she thought that turning the table on its side would work. Unfortunately, the chair across from hers, the one in which Vess had sat, was an obstruction that would most likely prevent the table from tipping over. She had to get rid of it, clear the way. Shackled as she was, however, and with the barrel pedestal intervening, she couldn't extend her legs far enough to kick at the other chair and knock it aside. Hobbled and tethered, she was also unable to stand and reach across the big round table and simply push the obstruction out of the way. Finally, she tried scooting backward in her chair, hoping to drag the table with her, away from Vess's chair. The chain encircling the pedestal drew taut. As she strained backward, digging her heels into the floor, it seemed that the piece was too heavy to be dragged, and she wondered if the barrel was filled with a bag of sand to keep the table from wobbling. But then it creaked and stuttered a few inches across the vinyl tiles, rattling the sandwich plate and the glass of water that stood on it. This was harder work than she had anticipated. She felt as though she was on one of those television shows devoted to stunts and stupid physical challenges, pulling a railroad car, a loaded railroad car. Nevertheless, the table moved grudgingly. In a couple of minutes, after pausing twice to get her breath, she stopped because she was concerned that she might back against the wall between the kitchen and the laundry room. She needed to leave herself some maneuvering space. Although it was difficult to estimate distance in the dark, she believed that she had dragged the table about 3 feet, far enough to be clear of Vess's chair. Trying to favor her sprained fingers, she placed her cuffed hands under the table and lifted. It weighed considerably more than she did. A 2-inch pine top, the thick staves in the supporting barrel, the black iron hoops around the staves, perhaps that bag of sand, and she couldn't get much leverage while she was forced to remain seated. The bottom of the barrel tipped up 1 inch, then 2 inches. The water glass toppled, spilling its contents, rolled away from her, dropped off the table, and shattered on the floor. All the noise made it seem as if her plan was working. She hissed, "Yes!" But then, because she had underestimated the weight and the effort required to move it, she had to relent, and the barrel slammed down. China flexed her muscles, took a deep breath, and immediately returned to the task. This time she planted her feet as far apart as her shackles would allow. On the underside of the table, she flattened her upturned palms against the pine, thumbs hooked toward herself over the smooth bullnose edge. She tensed her legs as well as her arms, and when she shoved up on the table, she pushed with her legs too, getting to her feet 1 inch at a time, 1 hard 1 inch for each inch that the table tipped up and backward. She did not have enough slack in the various tethering chains to be able to get all the way or halfway erect, so she rose haltingly in a stiff and awkward crouch, cramped under the weight of the table. She put enormous strain on her knees and thighs, wheezing, shuddering with the effort, but she persevered because each precious inch that she was able to gain improved her leverage. She was using her entire body to lift, lift, lift. The sandwich plate and the bag of potato chips slid off the table. China cracked and chips scattered across the floor with a sound unnervingly like scurrying rodents. The pain in her neck was excruciating, and someone seemed to be twisting a corkscrew into her right clavicle. But pain couldn't stop her. It motivated. The greater her pain, the more that she identified with Laura and the whole Templeton family, with the young man hanging in the motorhome closet, with the service station clerks, and with all the people who might be buried down in the meadow. And the more she identified with them, the more she wanted Edgler Vess to suffer a world of hurt. She was in an Old Testament mood, unwilling to turn the other cheek just now. She wanted Vess screaming on a rack, stretched until his joints popped apart and his tendons tore. She didn't want to see him confined to a state hospital for the criminally insane, there to be analyzed and counseled and instructed as to how best to increase his self-esteem, treated with a panoply of antipsychotic drugs, given a private room and television, booked in card tournaments with his fellow patients, and treated to a turkey dinner on Christmas. Instead of having him consigned to the mercies of psychiatrists and social workers, China wanted to condemn him to the skilled hands of an imaginative torturer, and then see how long the son of a bitch bastard freak remained faithful to his philosophy about all experiences being value neutral, all sensations equally worthwhile. This ardent desire, refined from her pain, was not noble in the least, but it was pure, a high-octane fuel that burned with an intense light, and it kept her motor running. This side of the barrel pedestal was off the floor, perhaps 3 inches. She could only guess, approximately as high as she had gotten it before, but she still had plenty of steam left. Bent in a backward Z, as hunched as a god-cursed troll, she muscled the table up, knees aching, thighs quivering with the strain, her butt clenched tighter than a politician's fist around a cash bribe. She encouraged herself aloud by talking to the table as if it possessed awareness. Come on, come on, come on, move! Shit, shit! Move, you son of a bitch! Higher, come on! Damn you, damn it! Come on! A ludicrous mental image of herself flashed through her mind. She must resemble a character in one of those movie scenes where the deceived cowboy cottons to the truth and overturns the poker table on the dishonest itinerant card shark, except that she was playing the drama in slow motion, as in a western underwater. Initially, the chair remained exactly where it had been when her butt had parted company with it, but as her arms lifted higher and stretched farther in front of her, the heavy chair was hoisted off the floor by the tightening chain that circled behind her from wrist to wrist and that wound through the vertical spindles behind the tie-on pad. Now she was lifting the table in front and the chair at her back, the hard edge of the seat jammed against her thighs and the curved pine headpiece of the railed back pressed cruelly below her shoulder blades, as the chair began to act like a V-clamp to prevent her from rising much further. Nevertheless, China squeezed against the table as she lifted it, separating herself from the confining chair enough to be able to rise out of her crouch just one more inch, then one more. At the extreme limits of strength and endurance, she grunted loudly, rhythmically, Sweat glazed her face, stung her eyes, but there was no light in the kitchen anyway, no reason that she had to see what she was doing in order to get it done. Her burning eyes didn't bother her. This was small-time pain, but she felt as though she was about to burst a blood vessel from the straining or throw a clot off an artery wall and recapture it deep in her brain. Fear was with her again for the first time in hours, because even as she strained against the table, she couldn't help thinking about what Edge Levesque would do with her if he returned home to find her on the floor, dazed and incoherent from a stroke. With her mind reduced to hasty pudding, she would no longer be the sophisticated toy that she had been. She'd be insufficiently responsive to provide him with the requisite thrills when he tortured her. Then perhaps Vess would revert to the crude turtle games of his youth. Maybe he would drag her into the backyard to set her on fire for the pleasure of watching her crawl jerkily in circles on crippled, blazing limbs. The table crashed onto its side hard enough to jar the dishes in the kitchen cabinets and rattle a loose pane in a window. Though she had been striving fiercely for precisely this result, she was so surprised by her abrupt success that she didn't cry out in triumph. She leaned against the curve of the tilted table and gasped for breath. Half a minute later, when she tried to pull away, she discovered that the chain was still wrapped tightly around the barrel pedestal and that she remained encumbered. She attempted to tug it loose. No luck. Dropping to her hands and knees, carrying the chair on her back, she reached under the canted table as though she were at the shore and seeking shade beneath a giant beach umbrella. In the darkness, she felt around the bottom of the barrel that served as the pedestal, and she discovered that this part of the job was not yet finished. The table was tipped on its side, like a mushroom with a large cap, stem meeting the floor at an angle. Given the position from which she'd had to work, she had not been able to tip it completely over with the pedestal straight up in the air. The bottom of the barrel, recessed inside a chime hoop, was fully exposed. However, the tethering chain was trapped in the angle between the floor and the side of the barrel. Lifting the chair with her, China struggled to her feet but rose only to a crouch. She reached down with both hands, hooked her fingers around the chime hoop, paused to gather her strength, and pulled upward. Although she tried to hold her injured trigger finger out of the way, her sweaty hand slipped on the painted iron hoop. She stubbed the fingertips of her right hand hard against the rough bottom of the barrel, and such a brilliant pain flashed through her swollen index finger that she cried out in dazzled agony. For a while she hunched over, protectively holding her injured hand against her breast, waiting for the pain to subside. Eventually it faded somewhat. After blotting her hands on her jeans, she hooked her fingers around the chime hoop once more, hesitated, heaved, and the barrel pedestal came off the floor half an inch. With her left foot, she pawed at the loop of the chain until she thought it was free, and then she let the pedestal drop to the floor again. She scooted backward in her chair, and this time nothing impeded her. The loop of chain rattled across the floor, no longer anchoring her to the table. Her chair bumped into the wall that separated the kitchen from the laundry room. She hitched sideways out from behind the table toward the window, which was but a faint gray rectangle between the blackness of the unlighted kitchen and the slightly less dark night. Although China was far from being free, farther still from being safe, she was exhilarated because at least she had done something. A headache like an endless incoming tide throbbed in waves across her brow and along her right temple, and the pain in her neck was savage. Her swollen index finger was a world of misery in itself. In spite of her thick socks, her ankles felt as though they had been bruised and abraded by the shackles, and her left wrist stung where she had skinned it while trying to yank the spindles out of the back of the chair. Her joints ached and her muscles burned from the demands she had put on them, and she had a stitch in her left side that was pulling like a needle threaded with hot wire. Yet she was grinning and exhilarated.